Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Something Something Podcast. My name is Eric Kasloff, and with me, as always, is Larry Sands. How's it going, Larry?
Oh man, everything is great, Eric, as usual. It seems like I feel I feel I'm a pretty positive person, right? And
Yeah.
it seems like every time you ask me, and maybe it's just the day, maybe I'm really super happy to be, on our podcast talking about creative stuff, but no joke, I really am doing great. Really,
Awesome.
really. Yeah, because I don't know. I just have, a feeling somebody's listening to this going, that guy always says he's fine. Oh, God, right. So I don't know. I don't know. How are you?
Man, my health journey is I'm 100% back to myself. It's
Nice.
just waiting on getting my partial dentures back,
Yeah.
it's I'm kind of embarrassed to go outside, and even now, seeing myself on video, I kind of want to hide my face like the Phantom of the Opera. But I'm sticking through it, man. I'm sticking through it. And also, this is my favorite time of the year. Baseball season has just started, and hopefully the Yankees won't embarrass themselves like they normally do. And God help the Mets. I'm always praying for them.
I love it. I love it. What's on the horizon creatively for you right now? Because I know collectively as the podcast, like we have our media company and
Mainly
stuff.
working on the next script, finishing it's done. I just have to go back and change a few references that I want to do and then figure out how we're gonna get it made.
Yeah.
I haven't, this is 3 years ago we made Hillsborough Road. It doesn't feel like
Jeez,
that long, but
man.
I need to get back on set. So I'm
Wow.
thinking about doing another short.
Why not? Absolutely do it. And speaking of Hillsborough Road, I'm doing sound design, and it's a snapshot really about a time in our life. It's like looking at an old photo, right?
I mean, I could tell you that was the last time I can say I was 100% happy and excited. The start of this year was rough with my
Yeah.
health issues, but
Yeah.
I'm doing good, man. But Larry, movies and TV are my biggest passion. And
Yes.
one type of TV show I absolutely love is the cop dramas. Like,
Yes.
I absolutely love Blue Bloods, Hill Street
Yes.
Blues. Well, I was too young for that, but I remember my grandparents watching it. But there was one show that was just so awesome, and that show was The Commish, which again,
Yeah.
and also I am partial to shows that take place in New York or New
Yes.
Jersey, any type.
Yes.
I am a homer, I'll admit that. And Larry, we have a connection to the Commish on right now. Tell everybody about our guest.
I am super excited to introduce this episode's guest, Anthony Shimbri. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
You are, and it's like Eric said, this is,
First
obviously
off,
our,
thank you for your service
oh,
to the city of New
yeah.
York. We say that to our soldiers a lot, and they deserve it, but so do, our first responders, our firefighters, our police officers, especially. I mean, everybody's the cool thing is to hate cops right now. But we need to stand up for our good cops because the good definitely outweigh the bad. So thank you for your service.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually let's really get in the start of this and talk about you have a new book and In Russia, A Brooklyn Solution.
Yes.
That's your new book. But I think it is worth noting because you were a police officer and you took a lot of your stories and your life and put this in your book. And, you know, we always, you know, before we record, we always talk to our guests, and you are no exception, because right off the bat, we're like, okay, this is great, because you are what the commish was based on, and you have so many stories. But reading your biography on your website, it says you were appointed by was it Mayor Cuomo? Mario Cuomo?
Governor Cuomo.
Yeah. Oh, you thank
wow.
you.
Yeah.
And what you have a storied life, and just reading your small little bio, I think doesn't do it justice, because in your bio you talk about so many things, and on your website you have so many amazing photos with people that are part of history. Tell us just a little bit about your background in law enforcement, because then that's going to feed into your book, I believe.
Yes, as a matter of fact, one of the characters in the book, a Russian detective, he asks McGalley, he says, how did you become a policeman in America? He says, well, when I was 14, I went to the police station with my neighbor to help them report that their uncle had been missing for 12 hours. So in front of us was a man who was reporting his dog missing. And the lieutenant took a report of the missing dog and promised him they would do whatever they could immediately. So when it was our turn, the lieutenant asked us, how long has the man been missing? We said 12 hours. He said, well, we don't take a missing person's report unless it's 48 hours. So I said, well, he was walking his dog at the time. So going up the stairs was a first grade detective, Johnny Burke, who heard it, and he motioned me to follow him. So I went upstairs to the detective squad room. He says, hey, kid, that was pretty fast of you. He said, you'd make a great detective. So he was typing with two fingers on an old Remington. And I said, wow, I said, two fingers, don't you type better than that? He says, you think you can do better? And I went, he opened the gate and I went in and I typed his report. So he got to, every time they got made a lot of arrests, he called me down if I would do some typing for them. And this was a time that was before civilians. And if I worked more than 2 or 3 hours, they'd always buy me lunch or, you know, okay, something to eat. And they sent the police car to pick me up.
Wow.
So it looked like I was a bad kid because I was going in and out of police cars.
That's but great.
By the time I was 17, I had 3 years investigating experience. Wow. In the 90 squad precinct. And I was like their mascot, or they took care of me, or, you know, and so that's how I got into law enforcement. And I saw Perry Mason and I saw Elliot Ness. So I couldn't make up my mind which one I wanted to be. So I became both.
Wow.
And I met Robert Stack. And wow, he gave me as a gift Elliot Ness's badge.
Oh, wow.
So I have in my den, I have Elliot Ness's badge. Probably worth some money too.
Wow.
Definitely, yeah.
You know?
Wow.
And
wow,
I used to call him up, and we went, I was invited to the Charlton Heston celebrity shoot, Sporting Clays. But, and it wound up to be, I won it.
Whoa.
So. Yeah. So he was the 1938 world ski champion, And he taught Spencer Tracy, Gary Cooper. And that's how he got into movie making through skeet shooting.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay. And we became just, you know, great friends, you know?
Wow. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. That's a, you know, actually you named everybody you named in that. Actually, obviously Eric and I know, and you know, a lot of people, the younger kids, I mean, let's face it, you know, they don't know who Elliot Ness is. They don't know, you know, Charlton Heston, Robert Stack. And that's what,
so cool.
What is that? Okay. I should ask Elliot Ness. Can you just, people that are listening and go, who is Elliot Ness? Can you give a little background on Elliot Ness?
Well, he was, he starred in the TV series, The Untouchables. As a matter of fact, when I would call him Ness, and he'd call me Kamish. So it was a wonderful relationship.
Wow.
I'm sorry it didn't start earlier in our lives, because he'd rather just sit and talk with a bunch of guys than people in the movies. He was that kind of guy, you know?
Wow. Wow. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Talk a little bit about your book. And is it loosely based on your life in service?
No.
Okay.
How this book happened is very interesting. When I was in law school, I got into an argument with one of the professors, which is pretty easy to do. And I took the position about whether it's too late to teach ethics to new lawyers mm-hmm. while they're in law school. So I said, I was a professor at several law, and I can write a curriculum. He said, well, why don't you write a curriculum? And you could satisfy the course requirements. So I said, boom, easy. So I submitted it. About a month later, I got the call down to the dean's office. What the hell does the dean want with me?
Yeah.
And I was a sitting police commissioner at the time. I was going to school at night. So the dean said, to make a long story short, she said, we'd like to adopt this course. It'd be the first one in the country. I said, you don't have to ask me for permission. If you want to do that, go right ahead. She says, no, we'd like you to teach it.
Wow.
I said, I haven't graduated yet. She says, you graduate in June. You'll go on to faculty in September. She said, wow. We've never done that before. You know, she says, could you? I says, boy, that's fine with me. So when it made the front page of the Law Journal, which is the Bible for lawyers, the Russians saw it and invited me down to the Russian embassy. They wanted to put an attaché in my class. I says, it's okay with me as long as the dean approves it. So I said, by the way, this is 1989. Serial crime was coming around the corner at us. And I was developing a course on serial crime. I taught it at UF, by the way. So I said, do you know what serial crime is? They said, well, our word for serial is serija in Russian. They said, we just executed a serial killer that killed 52 children over a 5-year period. Mm-hmm. And he turned out to be the wrong guy, because the Russian militia has no experience investigating serial crime.
Whoa.
Because it was an act thought to be of American democracy. So once he said that, that was the book. So on our way home, I got a yellow pad. I pulled over. I created 4 characters, including the vice premier of the Soviet Union and a female assistant DA from Brooklyn, and a Russian detective. And the 4 of them, the 3 of them go after this serial killer. Then what happens in the book is the premier and the Soviets, they get together and they say, we can't investigate this. We're embarrassed over it. They said, well, let's see if we could get someone to come and investigate, an outsider. So but they can't go to Scotland Yard because they were caught spying in England. They can't go to the Sûreté because the same problem.
Wow.
But the Secretary of State says, I know the police commissioner in New York. He says he's a friend of mine. We've had dinner. I'll call him. Maybe he could send somebody. So he calls the police commissioner. The police commissioner is elated that his department has been asked by another country.
Wow.
So he said, we'd be delighted. Now, I'll read this from the book.
Oh, yes.
Now, oh, please.
He goes, the police commissioner goes to see the chief of detectives. And the chief, when he goes to his office, the chief replied, the commissioner says, I wish I was the chief of detectives. All of the things that you have in your office, exciting, blood, knives, drugs, stolen goods. So he says to his chief, chief, who's the best detective in your 4,500-man bureau? And the chief didn't hesitate. He said, I know I'm going to be sorry. I said, Commissioner, first-grade detective Lieutenant Anthony McGalley, the department's serial crime expert. Why do you want to know, Commissioner? The commissioner smiled and let the chief wait. After a long pause, he gave him his answer. We're sending him to Russia to help solve the serial killings in the Soviet Union. The chief's eyes glazed over as he looked at the ceiling and states, heaven help the Russians.
I'm hooked. I am hooked. I'm hooked. I'm hooked. Wow.
I love it. I love it. I love it.
And this is the, and when he, this is the first sentence of the book. Okay. And you know, the first sentence of a book, I always thought really is a hook, like, call me Ishmael.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, who could ever forget that? It says here in the beginning, in Russia, death has a name and evil has a face. It was Yuri Shelnikov. If it could, no grave would have him.
Wow.
Wow.
He's the serial killer.
Wow.
The serial killer, they think he's the serial killer.
That's wild.
I'm hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah. How long did it take you to write your book?
I started it in 1989.
Yeah.
But because of the jobs I had a, you know, I ran the prison system in New York City.
Yeah.
I had 21,000 inmates, 14,000 offices. And the officers gave me more problems than the inmates.
I could imagine.
That so, sounds about right.
So, you know, these busy jobs I had going back and forth, I had to put it away. And you know, when you get an idea, I write these notes. And so I had a stack of 3x5 cards. So after moving to Florida, I thought I'd have the time. And then Governor Bush read about me. They did a story about me moving to Florida.
Wow.
He invited me up to Tallahassee to run the juvenile prison system, the Department of Juvenile Justice. So I did that for about 2 years.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, you were kind of busy.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
And you
not
know, you know,
much on, not that much going on.
Right,
so.
right. You know, that's the thing is everybody, I think, has a sense of, you know, like their projects, like when you're a creative person, but you have your non-creative life, which is your regular job and everything. And to me, I think because we talk to a lot of people who start their creative life, and whether it's writing a book or writing a movie, doing music, they have to put it aside every so often. And do you think that if you had written it right away, way back in 89, and took a couple years to finish it, do you think that it would be the book it is today if you had done it earlier?
No, because I used some of my cases. For example, in Brooklyn, we had five children that were killed in separate parts of the of Brooklyn, and we don't look. Detectives don't look at patterns; they look at the one crime that they have. So, when I looked at the autopsy reports, they all had nuts in their stomach. Now, why would five kids be killed in different parts of Brooklyn, all have nuts? So I said, look, send the nuts to the lab, see what they could tell me. So the lab calls and they said, they're nuts. I said, I know they're nuts. I sent them to you. They said, well, that's all we can tell. They said, we could send it to the FBI. I said, okay, send it to the FBI. So I get in touch with the FBI. The lab guy calls me up and he says, I said, what can you tell me? He said, they're nuts. I said, I know they're nuts. I sent them to you. He said, that's all we can tell you. He said, but there's an expert in the Department of Agriculture that the world's leading expert on nuts. I said, well, send it to him. So I can't get this guy on the phone for 2 weeks. Finally, I jump on a plane. I go to the Department of Agriculture. Wow. I walk in. You never seen a guy like this in your life. He's got an N on his tie. His name does not have the word N in it, okay? So his garbage pail is a big pistachio. Oh, this is to tell you what I'm dealing with. Wow. I said, listen, you, I sent you nuts 2 weeks ago, and I'm waiting for you. He says, well, he says, don't storm in my office. I says, look, these are the nuts of five children in their stomach. I want to know about any clues. What could you tell me? He said, well, it's got 5% riboflavin, 10% ash. I said, nah, nah, nah. Listen, I want to know for clues. He said, well, these nuts are filler nuts used in confectionery. And what does that mean? He said, well, they're filler nuts like they're using Cracker Jacks. We get a suspect under the driver's seat. A half-eaten box of Cracker Jacks.
You have got to be kidding.
When he pulls up to a kid, he offers the kid Cracker Jacks. The kid reaches in with his arm, grabs the kid's arm, pulls him through the window, drives away. Wow. That's in the book.
Wow. I'm
stuff like that you don't see on Law and Order.
No,
but the
you know
second
what?
You talked about storming into the guy, I just immediately envisioned Russell Crowe or Bruce Willis just, you know, beating this guy up to get the answers he wants.
I tell you, you know, okay, wait, there's one other story I know, because before we started to record, we had started talk and you had mentioned. What was the piece about the floor and the hair?
Well, I know what a jury likes. In one case, we had two sisters that were killed, and they were brought down to the basement, and they were cut up. And I found, when I moved the bureau drawer, I found hairs on the floor. So I said to the guy from the lab, I said, okay, I said, let's take the floor. He said, what do you mean the floor? You want a picture of the floor? I said, no, I want the floor. He says, how are we going to get the floor out of here? I said, you know those machines that go, you know, on the corner when they cut up the, yeah. I said, well, get me a machine that goes. So anyway, he said, well, how are we going to get it out of here? I said, well, take the wall down. He said, can you do that? I says, it's a crime scene. I own this house. Take the wall down. So we took the wall down, and then we rolled it into the courtroom on a big dolly. I stuffed the wheels with cardboard so it would roll in slowly and go past the jury, okay? And They couldn't believe the, and of course, defense counsel did somersaults saying you can't introduce a floor. The judge, as it happened, he and I used to go for lunch for Chinese food. So he when I brought him a case, for him, it was always fun, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how we introduced a floor in evidence.
Wow.
Oh, and then we got bones out of the lake. And I don't know if it was Christmas or birthday, I saw a dinosaur, and I got the idea. You know, the creative process is a wonderful process, how creativity comes to you. And I said, gee, if a guy could, I'll take it to the Smithsonian, because if a guy could put a dinosaur together, he could put these bones together for me.
Yeah.
So I put him in a bag and I took him to Washington. And I went and I said to the woman, what do you call the man who puts the dinosaurs together? She's the director of paleontology. I said, I'd like to see him, please. She said, do you have an appointment? I said, no, I got the bones of two bodies in this bag. I'd like him to put them together for me. She thought I was a crazy man. She called the Washington cops. I got arrested. They took me to Washington, D.C. They apologized. I apologized. I got so excited about the idea. I forgot to tell her who I was. Show her my badge. Anyway, they bring me back. Out comes the director of paleontology. He pick up a bone, fibula, tibula. I wish we had I don't have the picture here, but we have a picture of a, he put all the bones together in an exhibit with the bones on both sides of the skeleton. Wow. Okay. So those kinds of things impress a jury. They want to see evidence. Yeah. And they cut, you know, so I've taken door jams, fenders, you know, to me, I've taken shoes off people. Okay. That's in the book too.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
I was the inspector general. We had a riot on Rikers Island, and I took people's shoes off them. They didn't like that, of course. They complained to the mayor that I was taking shoes off them on Rikers Island. You could see what a headline that would make.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you talk about how creativity works really in every field, but especially with you in your field and how you did your investigations and how you handled yourself. What was your thought process? Because I can tell you just from you talking about this, I am so enthralled with your book. And
you're a very visual storyteller. Yes, I can only imagine, you know, that the same goes into your writing.
Yes.
And there's a lot of funny lines, by the way, in the book.
I can imagine.
Because, you know, when Magali goes to Russia and he meets his partner, Vladdy, he picks him up at the airport and he says, how long you been in the policing? And Vladdy says, we don't have policing. We have militia. I've been in the militia 40 years. And Magali goes, is this the same car you had when you started?
How did you decide? Because I think this, thinking about this, how did you decide to put the stories from your life or the situations from your life into the book?
That is a very good question. That's the hardest thing to do, is to find a place for it in the case or between the characters. Okay. For example, I switched Cracker Jacks to jelly beans. Okay. Because the Russians don't have Cracker Jacks.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
And then I got a scholarship to go to the Harvard Russian Research Center. Mm-hmm. I would go there on weekends. I talk to Russians, okay, and read some of these Russian books. For example, they misspell Migali's name because they did it with the Russians I met. They call him Migali. Okay. And he goes, that's Migali. Okay. So since they did that to me, I used that in the book. Okay. So there's a lot of funny parts in there. You know, funny things happen in homicide and murder cases.
Yeah.
And, in, you know, we don't have time, but I would tell you the funniest trial we had of a rape case that you would ever hear. I told that at Scotland Yard, and they couldn't, they laughed so hard, they had to get more tea.
Wow.
Of what happened to this jury. It was one of the funniest things. So funny things happen in, it's not all serious. You meet different characters, you know. Even wartime, in MASH, there's an episode where he says to the doctor, he says, President Eisenhower, good guy. And he says, I'll tell him you stop by. You know, that kind of things, yeah. that I've said all my life.
Yeah.
You know, found places for them.
Wow.
You know?
Wow. And is it just when you decide to put those situations or stories in there, then really does it become about connecting the dots?
Yeah, like when McGalley sees all of the evidence, they take all the evidence, they put it on the table, okay, for him to see it. And Vladdy says, we looked at all of this evidence, it tells us nothing. And McGalley picks up a book of matches. He says, it tells me something. He says, what does this tell you, my friend from Brooklyn? He says, it tells me that whoever struck these matches is left-handed. Because when you're left-handed, you put the matches in your right hand and you strike the matches from left to right. Okay? So he says, as Harrison Ford would say, you're digging in the wrong place.
I love that.
I love that reference. Oh, my That's gosh.
Awesome. Yeah, well, you know, I love that. I've always, since that picture, I've always used that term. It conveyed when people were making a mistake. And that's that's another thing, mistake. I hate the word mistake, because the word mistake is a bad word for a good try that didn't make it. Because people don't come into your office and say, I made a mistake. So when people work for me, I replace the word mistake with pizza. Why? Because everybody likes pizza. So people come in my office and say, I made a pizza.
Wow. Okay.
I say, yeah, sit down, tell me about it. Because if you don't fix your mistakes, your successor is going to fix them.
Wow.
So I always replace the word mistake with pizza. Let me tell you something. I give a lot of speeches, conference. I've got people 30 years later. I remember your speech with pizza. I've used it. It worked for me. I like things that work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And tell me, you know, it's how do you, because you had mentioned this before we even started to record, is what's it like working with you? What do you expect from people?
More.
That's odd.
More. See, running a police department is like running a dynamite factory where all of the employees are allowed to smoke. Okay?
Wow.
You give a guy who's 24 years old, you give him a badge, gun, summons, lights, sirens, and all of a sudden, boop, right to the head.
Right.
Okay? Wow. And I've had guys work for me. I had a detective who worked for me. No one liked him. Okay. But he was good with children. I could put him, and I wanted to keep that skill. So finally, one day I got sick of him. I said, I want you to go see the director of personnel at Carnegie Hall. Call me from the director's office. So a half hour later, he calls me and he says, I'm here. I says, what's the name? He says, so-and-so. He said, what do you want me to ask? I says, ask her for a job. He said, what? I said, ask her for a job, because all of the prima donnas work for Carnegie Hall, they don't work for me. And I hung up.
Wow.
Well, it must have been a long drive back to the office. He knocked on. See, that those are detectives, okay? Yeah. He said, I guess I needed that. I says, yeah, you did. You're going to get in the game, get a helmet, and we're going to, you know, I held out my arms. I said, hey, there are two ways of doing things here, my way or my way. Pick one or leave.
Mm.
So sometimes, and then sometimes you have to use humor. I had a cop for me. His paperwork was terrible, but he was good out there. But, you know, the paperwork. So one day I got the lieutenant wanted to bring him up on charges. So I said, I'll bring him in here. So I say, Jake, I said, listen, Jake, I'm going to the track tonight. I want you to help me pick 7 winners. He said, how can I do that? I says, is this your report? He says, yes. I says, aren't you predicting that these people are going to have an accident at this intersection a month from now? Oh, he said, I put the wrong date on it. You put the wrong, I thought you were predicting this accident. So I figured a guy that could predict an accident certainly can pick 7 winners. He says, Commissioner, I'm terribly sorry. It won't happen again.
Wow.
All right. So after that, he was so. Sometimes my sense of humor is able to elbow people over to that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, just out of curiosity, which track did you like going to? Because my grandpa, when I was a kid, used to take me to Meadowlands all the time.
No, I never bet on a horse in my life.
Oh, okay, okay.
I had a guy who bet on a horse. He had such bad luck, they gave him his tickets already ripped up.
Anthony, you're amazing. You really are amazing. And just listening to you, I kind of got lost in your story. I forgot what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely amazing. How
listen,
now?
The book comes out May 6th.
Oh, it's not out yet.
No. May 6th. Tell your listeners the book comes out May 6th.
Oh, well, you're telling them right now. Everybody, there's the book, and we'll put it on Instagram and everything. Yeah, that's
if
amazing.
You can get us a picture of it.
Yes,
we'll
I will.
Put it up on our Instagram.
There's two quotes on the back. One from the from Stephen Coe, former detective inspector, homicide, Scotland Yard.
Wow.
And another one from an attaché of the Russian embassy.
Oh,
that's geez. On the back.
Wow.
Okay. I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah. Wow.
I'll have we'll send you a book.
Oh my gosh, that would be amazing. That would be amazing. And actually, I am on your website. Let me read. It's Stephen Keough. Is that correct?
Yes.
Former directive inspector, Homicide Scotland Yard, an exhilarating read with an authenticity that only comes from an author. Oh, it only comes from an author who has lived and breathed their subject.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is that like? Because that you have worked with, and we haven't even gotten to the commish, but obviously, but what is that like for you to know that all these people, much like Stephen Keough from Scotland Yard.
Yeah.
What is that like for you to know that this is your first book?
I wrote 4 others, but they were, one was on criminal law, mm-hmm. one was on leadership, one was on corrections, and one was on policing, law enforcement.
Wow.
But this is my first novel.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. What's that like for you to read something like that from really the top of the top?
You know, it's funny. Sometimes I'm amazed at, you know, some of the things I've went through, but I always, I never look at the rearview mirror. I look at the front windshield. So I'm always looking ahead, but sometimes you sit back and you reflect and listen, it's not all success. I was just interviewed for superintendent of the Massachusetts State Police.
Wow.
And I didn't get it. They only brought in 10 people. I was one of 10 people. And I'm sure I didn't get it because I'm 81.
Mm.
Who's, you know, I mean, I get headhunters call me and they say, Anthony, your age. I says, here's the way I handle this. I was recently mugged in England, in Chinatown, coming out of Chinatown. And we had to take them to the emergency room. Okay. So that's how I have a list of his injuries. Okay. And it's in the police report. So when people say, what about your age? I say, this is what happened to the mugger in Chinatown in England.
Wow.
So I have to deal with that now. I mean, it's terrible that I want to take over a department again.
Right.
I want to take over a department again. Yeah. But I'm fighting age, and it's terrible. I just got a call from a city that's trying to talk me into handling the police accountability board. That's internal affairs.
Mm.
I don't want to do it. I've done that once before. My name became an obscenity on department walls, on the bathroom walls. I don't want to do that. I want to run a department again.
Wow.
I'm looking around, but I'm finding that people, my age is a problem.
You know, that's the thing. And it's like,
LA is looking for a police chief.
Oh,
okay.
Oh.
Now, if this new mayor there, the chief has left.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even take a plane to go there because it would slow me down. So I would love to get the LAPD job.
Wow.
But she's not going to appoint an 81-year-old police chief.
Mm.
You know?
Anthony, go ahead.
No, I mean, I'm in great shape. People say, I can't believe you're 81.
Right. You know? Right. You know, then, and I think, and I mean, 81, I mean, it just occurred to me. Well, it never really actually occurred until now is you are a very young 81.
Yeah.
It's so weird because, you know, when you do acting and things, this comes up a lot. Right. And it's the ageism. It's, you know, obviously you can't take a 50-year-old and play, you know, 20 forever when you're an actor. But it's really the same thing because you have a young sensibility about you.
Exactly.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to be able to have that. And I completely understand, you know, how that itches at you, because it's not so much the age, it's the know-how and the knowledge that you bring with that.
The wisdom
and,
that you
yeah,
have.
Yeah. And
thank you.
Gosh, Anthony, I tell you, man, I wish we could just tell people listening to this that I mean, you've got it. You've got it still.
Yeah.
You
can use us as references if
you
want.
Yeah, exactly.
This is my first broadcast. No,
this
probably.
Is? This
yeah.
Is?
Yeah.
This is, oh, my gosh.
No.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
You've done a fantastic job.
Seriously.
Wow. Wow, you've really, you know what, that's a thing. I like to think that our podcast really kind of wants to go where it wants to go, and all the questions that come out and all the creativity that gets talked about.
How am I doing so far?
You're doing great. Fantastic.
Amazing.
You're doing fantastic. Yeah, very much a natural.
I'm glad you like my stories.
Oh my gosh. Amazing. Do we like them? Yeah. This is the epitome, I think, of the creative process with the creator being able to take their life story, really, and make it like another story. But you, what's it called, Eric? Like fiction, like historical fiction or something? Or would that be it?
No,
probably
it's
not.
More autobiographical. Well,
the book is fiction.
Yeah. But
it comes from a real case, though.
That's absolutely it. You've put your life and your life's work and your passion, and I would assume, you know, the sadness that comes with these cases, right? And the stress, and you've put it in a way where you're going to teach somebody about what you do, and they're going to be amazed at the things that you've witnessed in your life.
And that's why I love teaching in college.
Yeah.
I've been teaching for about 50 years. I wrote a book on criminal law, and I teach criminal law a lot different, because I'll, you know, believe it or not, criminal law can be boring because it's definitions. You know, it's definitions. Like I'll start my first class and I'll say, "I hate my neighbor," and the class becomes quiet. I said, 3 o'clock in the morning, I shoot him while he's in bed. I run out the door. The police catch me. I'm arrested for murder. They do an autopsy. They find out he died of a heart attack 3 hours before I shot him. And then I point to one of my students. I go, "You, what crime did I commit?" You know what I get? Jackie Gleason. So, and that was a real case.
Wow.
I went to the United States Supreme Court. Okay. Then they charged him with murder. Okay.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's attempted murder, actually. Wow. And then I said, Lady Largebottom in England goes to France and she buys some lace. She smuggles it into England. She's arrested for smuggling. Turns out to be British lace, which no duty was applied because she was frauded in France. Did she commit a crime?
No.
So, you know, a man goes into a grocery store. He says, puts $20 on a counter. He's going to have change. Guy opens up the cash register. Man produces a gun, reaches in the cash register, grabs a bunch of cash, runs out the door. He forgets the $20 bill on the counter that he put there, and it only comes to $15. Is it against the law to give somebody $5 at gunpoint?
Wow.
Anthony.
Criminal law becomes alive.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah.
And my students always get high marks, high grades.
Wow.
They really get to know it, you know?
Wow. And it is something to be said, because it's you really are a wordsmith, and you have this great way of not only telling a story. And I haven't even read your book, but I would assume that listening to you and reading your book are almost one and the same, I think.
Well, you know, when you say wordsmith, it reminds me of the blacksmith getting a helper for the first day. And he tells his helper, he says, "When I take this horseshoe out of the fire, I'm going to place it on the anvil. When I nod my head, you hit it."
Wow.
You didn't get it yet. I'll wait.
Wait, can you tell you me one more
now.
time?
You got it now. On the way to the hospital. So wordsmith you have to be.
Yeah. I tell you.
I always look forward to telling that one.
I tell you, Anthony, you really have brightened my day. Seriously. I tell you. So your book comes out May 3rd, did you say?
May 6th.
May 6th. Yeah. I wonder if we could set something up with you to do another, like a quick interview with you to see what it's like for you.
You tell me I'm available.
Definitely. Yeah. Let's do that.
Okay. All right. Because I know, you know, it's like Eric said at the top of the show, you have been amazing. Amazing.
It was an honor having you on. It really brightened up my day. And I knew 10 minutes into you talking, there was going to need to be a sequel.
Yes.
Again, Anthony, thank you so much for coming on. The book comes out May 6th. We will have him on as soon as possible after the book's release. Again, Anthony, thank you so much for sharing your stories with us.
My pleasure. Nice to meet both of you.
Nice meeting you.
Goodbye now. Take care.
And like we say each and every week, everybody, remember, support our troops.